ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit LeggMason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, really excited about the show this week. As always, I want to thank the exclusive sponsor of ETF Prime, Legg Mason. So I think anyone following this podcast, or if you follow me on Twitter, you know I'm supportive of a Bitcoin ETF. Now, doesn't mean I think everyone should own Bitcoin in an investment portfolio. I just believe that if we're going to be consistent, given the other ETFs and investment products that exist, I just have a hard time reconciling why a Bitcoin ETF hasn't been approved yet. I mean, you can invest in triple leverage natural gas ETFs, a dry bulk freight futures ETF. I could rattle off 50 other products that would raise some eyebrows, but no Bitcoin ETF. So this week, we're going to dive headfirst into this topic. We'll be joined by Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise. They actually pioneered the first cryptocurrency index fund. They also previously filed for a crypto index ETF, and they currently have a Bitcoin ETF pending with the SEC, where a final decision is expected later this year. So we're going to talk about the status of that ETF. And then look, I have a bunch of questions for Matt on some of the issues I have with a Bitcoin ETF still not being approved. Just to give you another example, there's something called the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust that trades over the counter with like a 35% premium. So grandma and grandpa can own this thing in their E-Trade account. There's actually an Ethereum version as well, but yet there's no Bitcoin ETF, which would resolve the premium issue. There are also Bitcoin futures, including physically settled futures that will be made available to retail investors, but no futures-based ETFs. Why is that? So we're going to get into all of this with Matt. And then look, I think it's important to cover both sides of any debate, right? Not everyone believes a Bitcoin ETF should exist. So we're going to keep Matt on the line and bring in Tyrone Ross, who, if you're not familiar with Tyrone, Investment News recently named him to their 40 under 40. Wealthmanagement.com selected him as a top 10 advisor set to change the industry. And most relevant to us this week, Tyrone knows the crypto space inside and out, and he's been pretty vocal against the Bitcoin ETF. So we're going to have a fun, spirited debate on this topic. And Jason, I know you're not necessarily the most supportive of a Bitcoin ETF either, which in our conversations, I know is partly a reflection of just how new and early crypto is. Everyone's still learning here.
Hey, Nate, no one carries the banner like our shop for democratizing investing in ETFs. But I do take a little pause. I think should everything under the sun be wrapped inside an ETF wrapper for public consumption? I guess that's another debate. We do have a system where certain investments are reserved for what's termed accredited investors. And there's debate about whether that's fair, too. But for right or wrong, our industry tries to protect some of the public from itself, from making investments in things that they don't understand or are too risky. And I think there's still, in my mind, question about Bitcoin and the real risks involved. You know, forget about the stability of the price. That price chart over the last 5 years will make your head spin. It looks like a roller coaster on steroids. But do we really know all the risks yet? Can a few of the big whales that still own the majority of the Bitcoin, you know, push the price around? You know, I think it would be foolish to think that there aren't armies of data scientists around the world, sovereign nations, looking at backdoors and doing backclicks to try to figure out, are there any vulnerabilities? I mean, that's just how things work. So at the end of the day, I'm a supporter of every man. I mean, we all deserve the right to look at opportunity and pursue what we want to pursue. But based on some of the questions I get from my clients and really the public in general and some of the lack of knowledge on the subject itself, I just take a little bit of pause.
No, I think those are all good points, and that's what makes this an interesting debate. So this should be fun today. Matt and Tyrone are both fantastic, really smart guys, great people. And I'm also going to ask Tyrone about Facebook's Libra coin, because he has some strong views on this as well. And on the topic of Facebook's Libra, we're actually going to start this week with ETF.com's Dave Nottig. He wrote what I thought was a brilliant piece on how Facebook's Libra is actually structured very similar to an ETF. And what's interesting about that is, if you play this forward, you can make the case that perhaps the natural evolution of ETFs is on the blockchain, that maybe we all just transact our basket of securities via some sort of crypto asset and cut out the middlemen. But I think at a minimum, Dave's piece is a really good learning tool on cryptos and ETFs, so we'll start there this week. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at etfprime. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, we would greatly appreciate if you could drop us a quick review on Apple Podcasts. All right, let's chat with ETF.com's Dave Nottig.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Honestly, I've got to tell you, this piece you wrote on Facebook's Libra was one of the most fascinating pieces I've read all year. You went in an entirely different direction than I was expecting. And by the way, for listeners, this is currently posted at ETF.com. It's titled Most Interesting ETF Filing Ever, Libra. Definitely check that out if you haven't already. Let's start with what Libra coin is, or I guess what it's proposed to be. Do you want to try and describe this?
Sure. I mean, we should recognize we're working off of what's been published in effectively a white paper, so that we don't really even have a full, like a functional test net or anything like that. So we don't actually know exactly how it's going to work at the sort of minutiae of the blockchain level. But at the end of the day, what Facebook and the Libra organization is proposing, and we should point out this is not just Facebook, it's Visa and another couple dozen folks that are associated with this, all as sort of part of an industry consortium. They're proposing that, much like an ETF, they create a mechanism for people to buy, or rather create, chunks of Libra for, say, you know, a couple million dollars at a pop, and then that couple million dollars then goes into some sort of pool. Presumably it would be in a trust or something like that, which would then invest in a basket of currencies, which, you know, to my mind, that looks a lot like a currency fund of some sort. But they go further, and they actually outline a class of investor that's allowed to do this creation and redemption of blocks of Libra, much like you would do, say, blocks of SPY or any other ETF. And then from there, then that's when it gets interesting, because everything I just described doesn't have anything to do with the blockchain. It's just, here's a mechanism to get a unitized claim on a pool of assets that uses a creation redemption process. And then those units are what we are going to call Libra or Libra coin, which are the things that the Libra organization is hoping to use in transactions. So it's sort of really two things in one. There's this ETF component to it, which is sort of how money gets in and how it's pegged to this basket. And then there's the second part, which is how do you and I exchange our ownership in Libra to buy a hamburger?
Do we know who is actually, or who would actually manage the basket of currencies underlying Libra? Because when I think of the potential scale of this, it's a bit frightening. I mean, somebody's going to be responsible for making sure this thing doesn't break the buck, right? If this scales enough, that could be an interesting situation.
Well, interestingly, you know, this is going to break the buck on day one because it's not just all going to be invested in U.S. dollars. So, you know, for your listeners who are used to talking about Bitcoin and other things, this is not a stable coin in the sense that there is a one-for-one peg between what a Libra coin is worth and a U.S. dollar is worth. This is literally a fund that's going to invest in the U.S. dollar, but it's also going to invest in the euro and the yen and who knows what else. And no, they haven't established, say, an investment manager. They haven't officially said there's going to be a trust and trustees. That's all still very vague. And so this is a little bit like somebody coming out with an article saying, I have a great idea for an ETF, but then they haven't actually filed the paperwork yet. And that's part of why I think this is so interesting, because this is more a statement of intent than an actual product at the moment.
Well, on that intent, look, I don't want to spend a bunch of time speculating on Facebook's motivations. Libra has obviously generated some controversy just given Facebook's issues with data privacy. But at a basic level, what do you view as the purpose of LibraCoin or Facebook's overall goal here?
Well, so their stated goal is to provide a sort of universal transaction system for the quote-unquote unbanked, which is actually a huge portion of the world. I think it's roughly like a third of the world, doesn't have any relationship with a financial institution whatsoever. And this would create an opportunity for those folks to have another transaction system, which is similar, for instance, to what Alibaba has done with Alipay in Asia. It's similar to what the Kenyan eCoin has done for that market as well. So there are sort of similarities to other systems, but it's worth pointing out that the initial reaction after the announcement and the sort of initial discussion of Libra has actually been quite negative. India, which is sort of one of the key target markets here, it's one of the largest unbanked populations in the world, they actually came out in the last week and said, absolutely no way, that they're actually talking about potentially criminalizing the private use of Bitcoin, much less something like Libra. So the reaction from governments has been quite strong so far. I think, you know, if the stated objective is probably part of the equation. I think the other pieces of the equation are to have this regulatory discussion about where digital currencies can exist in the ecosystem legally and with regulation. And also, I think if you were thinking more nefariously, this creates an awfully large information stream about how people and where and when people transact that would be in the hands of this consortium, which, frankly, whatever they say now, two-thirds of the people in the consortium can vote to completely change how Libra works, which is one of the slightly scarier parts of the whole thing.
Dave, Jason here. On the subject of outcry from, you know, interested parties, I think I read in the last 24 hours the People's Bank of China came out and said very vocally that Libra, and, you know, as the white paper states, ought to be managed or overseen by central banks. Is it safe to say that anybody with some skin in the game is going to try to get ahead of whatever comes out with Libra and try to influence the process in this?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And I do think that, you know, part of the reason why I think this is so interesting is not because I think we're going to live in some sort of Blade Runner future where Libra is the thing we transact in every day, but because I think this will be the canary in the coal mine for regulators. And I actually think that's very important. I think it's actually important to the crypto ecosystem to have a proactive discussion with regulators about how this works. Because think about it, this is now not a stable coin, which means if I buy something from you, then theoretically, I've incurred a capital gain or loss because I have now, quote unquote, sold a Libra coin for a cheeseburger. And I probably am doing that at a different peg to the dollar than, say, the day I bought it, even if it's just a minuscule difference. That's a huge headache, right? So that's a discussion that needs to happen at the federal level about what happens when I transact in something. Is that a realized gain? There's a long laundry list of things that the crypto industry writ large really does need a positive conversation with regulators about. And I think this is the probably the thin end of the wedge that makes that happen.
Well, and Dave, to your point, just last week we saw a group of Democrats on the House Financial Services Committee. They sent a letter to Facebook actually asking them to stop development on Libra. But I think to your point, that's a good thing. It's sparking this conversation, this discussion, which, you know, in my view, has been a bit slow to manifest itself. Going back to how Libra is structured, very similar to an ETF, you know, I think what most captured my imagination in your piece was that you sort of connected the dots to some broader futuristic possibilities here. And you said, look, if Libra successfully allows transactions on the blockchain, why can't that be extended to any other ETF,
yeah,
right? Because ETFs are simply baskets of securities. And so maybe Libra is showing us the next evolution for ETFs where we cut out some of the middlemen. How real of a possibility do you think that is? And how far away could we be from something like that?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. It's just a question of how long. So you're asking the right question there. You know, when you think about the global financial systems, you know, right now, you know, you want to go spend money, you want to wire money to somebody, you want to use your credit card. Most of those transactions are verified instantaneously. And really, there's a very electronic, modern settlement system for those kinds of cash transactions. But when I go to sell a security, I actually go through a very Byzantine, overnight, sort of 1970s era batch process that matches up buyers and sellers overnight at the NSCC and the DTCC. And that's a system that is just creaky and ripe for replacement. And there are quite a few folks in regulatory circles that are talking about replacing the trade and settlement system that we use for securities with something on the blockchain. It's an inherently superior system for these kinds of mass transactions that need instant verification. So, you know, the idea that somehow Libra would sort of create the first blockchain-based settlement system, that to me is super exciting, because once you do that, then I can move one share of SPY to your account in exchange for hopefully more than one cheeseburger, maybe a big steak dinner. And that becomes really interesting. You know, it has profound implications for how securities are traded, the role of exchanges, the role of, you know, alternative trading venues. I think this is really a brave new world. As far as how long, I do think this is years off. I think this is very early days, and whether Libra or Bitcoin or any of these are the sort of ultimate digital currency, I think the use of something like blockchain to enable day-to-day transactions is frankly inevitable.
It's really interesting, and look, the bottom line is we know there's going to continue to be evolution here. You go back to the 1920s, everything was paper-based, right? And
right,
we've obviously made changes since that point, and there's no reason to believe that's not going to continue to evolve moving forward. Dave, before we let you go, we are going to talk Bitcoin ETFs this week with Matt Hogan and Tyrone Ross, and we won't steal their thunder here, but I'm not sure if I've ever pinned you down on this. In your opinion, should a Bitcoin ETF exist right now?
I do think one should exist because we're in this sort of never-never land where the alternative is frankly worse for investors, right? Effectively, because we don't have something like an ETF, the regulators are saying, okay, if you want exposure to this, you either have to move to this unregulated sort of gray market of the crypto exchanges, which we all know the problems there have been there, particularly on the exchange side. Or you have to go buy an overseas security, because you can buy exchange-traded notes in Europe that track various cryptocurrencies. That's a little sketchy. Or you have to end up in something like GBTC, which you talked about, which is not an ETF, but sort of positions itself that way, but is subject to huge premiums and discounts. I think a Bitcoin ETF would actually solve an investor problem and create more direct and understandable exposure for those investors who want to participate in the space. So I think it's a little bit inevitable, and I think it's just a matter of time.
Well, Dave, as always, enjoyed our chat this week. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. See you next week.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nodig. All right, our next guest is Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise, who's a leading provider of rules-based exposure to the crypto asset space. They actually pioneered the first cryptocurrency index fund, and they currently have a Bitcoin ETF filed with the SEC. Matt is unique because he's actually a longtime ETF industry veteran. So he was previously CEO of ETF.com, also Inside ETFs. He actually still serves as a chairman of Inside ETFs. And he co-authored what I would say is the ETF Bible, the CFA's Institute's Comprehensive Guide to ETFs. But now, of course, Matt is heavily involved in the world of crypto assets, and he's on the line with us from San Francisco. Matt, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Matt, let's start with what I know everyone wants to hear, which is, what can you tell us about Bitwise's Bitcoin ETF filing? And look, I'll give you a little bit of a wiggle room here. I know there are certain things you can't comment on, given this is currently with the SEC, but what can you tell us?
Sure. Yeah. It's going along well is the answer. So we're in the regular review process. There are two more deadlines in front of us. One is in August. One is in October. And so our expectation is that we won't hear anything until around October 11th. But at that point, we'll see what they say, yes or no.
I know back in May, Bitwise submitted a Bitcoin research paper to the SEC, which, by the way, this thing blew my mind, the amount of work and effort your team put into this. But the conclusion of the report was that Bitcoin's spot trading market should be among the most orderly and efficient in the world. And again, I'll give you a free pass here if you can't comment, but why don't you think the SEC is viewing it that way at this point in time?
Yeah, you know, I actually think the SEC is doing a great job, and I'm not just saying that to suck up to them. Look, the Bitcoin market has come a long way in the last couple of years. Back when the Winklevoss ETF application was filed, I don't think the market was ready for an ETF. It was relatively inefficient. Custody wasn't solved. Big market makers like Jane Street hadn't come in. Arbitrage wasn't that good. It's really only been in the last couple of years, or really in the last year, that the Bitcoin market has matured. So I think it's just a matter of timing. And now, you know, the SEC is going carefully through our research. They've asked some very good questions. I think it's a matter of when and not if. And I think we're getting closer every day. But I actually think they're doing a good job. And I think it just was that the market wasn't ready 18 months ago. And now I hope that it is.
As you mentioned, the SEC does have to make a final decision on this ETF by October. Let's just say they deny it. What happens from there? Do you simply refile the ETF and then the clock starts all over again?
Yeah, I think that's the likely scenario if that happens. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But if it does, you know, we'll take a look at their concerns and we'll try to address them. I think they always come back with good questions. They've done that throughout the process that we've been involved in. And if they find a reason to reject it, we'll just reflect, do more research, submit another 500 or 600 pages of documents, and, you know, hopefully eventually wear them down.
All right. So, look, I haven't shied away from the fact that I do believe a Bitcoin ETF should have been approved by now. I just think there are so many other ETFs out there that are far more dangerous to investors than a Bitcoin ETF. And I know just being better than the worst options, that's not enough in some people's eyes. And I get that. But I'm just of the belief that as long as risks are properly disclosed and the products do what they say, we have to put some responsibility on investors to do their homework. But all that aside, I want to ask you about a few situations in particular where I really find it hard to wrap my head around the fact that a Bitcoin ETF doesn't exist. And hopefully we can do this without getting too far into the regulatory weeds. I'll let you shoulder that burden. First, we have to talk about this Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, ticker GBTC, right? So this thing trades over the counter, currently at a 35% premium to net asset value. And actually, an Ethereum product was recently made available to retail investors as well. How in the world is this able to exist but not a Bitcoin ETF?
those occupy an ugly regulatory loophole. I don't think anyone except for Grayscale is happy that those exist. You're exactly right. Those are dangerous for investors. People don't realize that they're trading at large premiums. The Ethereum product you mentioned traded at a 10x premium, which is just ridiculous. And, of course, that premium collapsed, and, of course, retail investors were hurt. The products are actually worse maybe than you're even envisioning, because the way that they're created is that rich investors who meet the accreditation principles can create new shares at net asset value. and then they just have to wait a year, and then they can sell them on the market to retail investors at the elevated price. Look, it was the only way that Grayscale could get a product to market, and there's certainly people who are happy that there's a brokerage-accessible product, but I think they're dangerous to investors. I think they're toxic products, and I wish they didn't exist.
Well, even worse, some people think these are ETFs, which give ETFs a bad name. But at the end of the day, so basically some regulatory loopholes are allowing these to exist.
Yeah, that's right. If you create an accredited product and then you wait and hold it for a year, you're allowed to list it on the OTCQX, which you and I used to call the pink sheets before they went through a rebranding. And that's the regulatory loophole that lets them exist. There's no way for the SEC to stop them from existing. I don't know how they feel about them, but that is the regulatory loophole through which they get onto an exchange-traded market. But the way to think of them as closed-end funds with large premiums, and eventually the scary thing is the potential for large discounts. If an ETF come to market, I expect that the premium on GBTC will collapse, because people will have an alternative, and you may even see that product trade to a discount. So I
completely
think,
agree.
People say Bitcoin is risky, but holding a closed-end fund trading at a premium of Bitcoin is too risky for anyone.
All right, another one I have a hard time reconciling. How is it that Bitcoin futures contracts exist but not a Bitcoin ETF? And I'm sure you saw the CFTC actually recently approved physically settled Bitcoin futures from LedgerX. And these will be available to retail investors. So if the CFTC thinks it's okay for Bitcoin futures to trade, why can't those futures be wrapped in an ETF? What difference does it make?
Right. Well, I think you have to think they're just different regulators. I mean, the CFTC typically serves a different audience and has different standards. The right way to think about the SEC, I think of them a little bit like the FDA. And you may not know this, but I was a biotech analyst in a previous life. And the thing about the FDA is people look at medicines and new medicines, and they all focus on the efficacy, like, does it help save patients? And the FDA actually doesn't care that much about efficacy. They care about safety. They're a do-no-harm regulator. And the SEC fits that mold. They want to be progressive and forward-thinking, but they are a do-no-harm regulator, and they don't want to put their stamp on a product until they feel totally confident that it will do what it claims to do. And the CFTC is just a little bit more aggressive on the regulatory front. So just different regulatory agencies. But look, one thing crypto people forget is that each time a new asset class has been opened in ETFs, it's taken many years. It took 7 or 8 years for levered ETFs to come to market. It took multiple years for bond ETFs to come to market. The World Gold Council spent $12 million on legal fees, a figure that makes me shudder, to get a gold ETF onto the market. So it's not atypical for it to take a long time. We move in crypto time. We expect things done overnight, 24/7. But the SEC moves at a different cadence. I do think they're getting closer, though. I think that's the most important thing.
All right, and I'm going to give you one more here. I think you answered this with your comments on the SECs, but I am going to try and really test your regulatory knowledge here. why not a Bitcoin ETN? Right. So this is simply a bank guarantee to provide the return stream of Bitcoin. So if a bank is willing to underwrite that, why can't a Bitcoin ETN exist?
Right. Well, the first thing is, do you have a bank that's willing to underwrite it? Of course, Bitcoin ETNs exist on Nasdaq Nordic, the Swedish market. So they are out there. The honest answer is that the SEC is taking a sort of holistic approach to this everywhere they can, which is saying we're not allowing a Bitcoin ETP on the market until we're totally comfortable with it. So an ETN, when I first got involved, we went down that pathway because we thought for the reasons you suggest, it would be easier. You wouldn't have to deal with custody, et cetera, et cetera. But the SEC is really concerned about the fundamental market. So they're going to block, I believe, any attempt to list a Bitcoin ETP in any flavor. Even these attempts to list ETPs that are, say, 10% Bitcoin and 90% Treasury, I think those are doomed for failure as well until the SEC is comfortable with the idea of a Bitcoin ETP. You're not going to wiggle your way into this. You're going to have to go straight through, and it's only when they get fully comfortable that they'll open the floodgates. People have tried to be cute. I don't think the SEC is looking for cute. I think they're looking for sort of their fundamental issues about Bitcoin resolved, and I think hopefully that's what we'll give them.
By the way, we had Phil Bock, who is CEO of Exponential ETFs, on the show last year, and I asked him a similar question on a Bitcoin ETN. He had a fantastic response that I think you'll get a kick out of. He said asking the SEC to write a Bitcoin futures contract into the ETN rule set would be like asking the NFL permission to add spikes to shoulder pads, which I just thought was great. Matt, before we move on, because we're going to bring in Tyrone Ross and have a fun, spirited debate on the merits of a Bitcoin ETF, just in terms of whether one should even exist in principle, not even from a regulatory perspective, I do want to ask you about the price of Bitcoin, because it's up, what, over 200% this year. Is there any way to discern some of the drivers here? Any idea what's sparking the move?
Yeah, well, you know, one, the bear market was exhausted and oversold. And you knew that back in April when some bad news broke, like Binance was hacked. The Tether situation was unveiled, and Bitcoin didn't go down anymore. So you knew that the bear market was exhausted. Then two things happened. One, you got the first wave of institutional investment into the space, and you knew that was happening because the amount of futures volume versus spot volume spiked. So you started to see real institutional investors take positions in Bitcoin futures, and that brought new money into the space. And then it was really accelerated by the Facebook news, not for the reason people think. People think the Facebook news was good because it got sort of crypto front and center, and it was a gateway drug to Bitcoin and all those things. I don't think that's right. I think the reason the Facebook news was good was that you saw how the government pounced on it, right? The same day that Facebook came out, the government announced hearings on it. They were going to shut it down. I think that reified in people's minds the fact that you can't do that with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a non-sovereign entity. It can't be shut down. You can't call it for hearings. It showed people the power of a decentralized, non-sovereign store of value. And I think all of those are doing well right now. Gold is doing well. Oil is doing well. And Bitcoin is doing well. So call it a recovery rally with a few catalysts. I think it brought us back to a sort of normalized price. And we're relatively bullish for the rest of the year. So I think that's what's going on.
On your note regarding Facebook's Libra, we talked about this a little bit earlier with ETF.com's Dave Nodig. But I think Libra is obviously leading to some discussions in Washington, D.C., just around what the future of money looks like. And that's a discussion that maybe has been a bit lacking. So I think Facebook, because of who they are, just bringing out the role of cryptos, even though that's different, right? It's centralized, and there's certainly a number of differences between what Libra would be and Bitcoin. Just having this conversation and getting regulators to start looking into this world, I think, is a huge positive. Matt, if you don't mind, hang on the line with us. I'm going to bring in Tyrone Ross, and we'll get rolling on this Bitcoin ETF debate. I've got to tell you, hope you came prepared, because Tyrone always brings it strong. So we're going to have our work cut out for us here, but this should be a lot of fun.
I'm ready.
We are now joined by the man, the myth, the legend, Tyrone Ross. He's a financial consultant to young professionals and founders. He's an advisor to financial technology startups. And most importantly for us this week, Tyrone knows the crypto asset space inside and out. He's really risen to become a knowledge expert in this area. I also have to mention, Tyrone has a unique backstory. He actually qualified in the 400 meters for the 2004 Olympic trials. And I've had a chance to visit with Tyrone just about his career path. I've got to tell you, he's somebody who's fought and grinded and overcome some real adversity to get where he is today. And that's all paying off now. Tyrone was recently named by wealthmanagement.com as a top 10 advisor set to change the industry. Investment News just named Tyrone to their 40 under 40. And we are now very excited to have Tyrone joining us via phone from New Jersey. Tyrone, great connecting again. Thanks for joining us this week.
Thank you for that illustrious intro. My mom will be very proud. So thank you very much. I appreciate you for having me. This is a blessing, and thanks for sharing your platform.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And look, we're going to have some fun today and debate the merits of a Bitcoin ETF. But before we do that, I don't think I've heard the story. How did you first become interested in crypto?
I was at Merrill Lynch, and I had a friend of mine who was a Ruby developer and just into computers. He was like the one who was making our fake IDs when we were in high school and all of that. And he reached out and was like, you know, I need to tell you about Bitcoin and whatever. And I was like, this sounds completely ridiculous. And he stayed on me and stayed on me and stayed on me. And eventually, you know, he's just like, all right, look, download this app. I'm going to send you some. And I downloaded Bread Wallet, and he sent me some Bitcoin. And then he, in turn, had me send it to somebody else. And I was kind of like, all right, I'm in now. I need to figure out what's going on here. So shortly after that, he put me in a Facebook group chat with a whole bunch of people, smart cryptographers and, you know, computer science majors and engineers. And I had nothing to add to the conversation, but I'm looking and I'm like, man, they're giving each other some terrible investment advice. So I'm like, there's an opportunity here. And that's where the light bulb went off that, you know, being a crypto asset advisor is something that I should probably look into doing.
Well, and once you sort of crawl down that crypto rabbit hole, it's tough to get out. I found myself in that as well. Once you start learning and seeing what's going on in the space, it's just there's a thirst to want to learn more. Tyrone, so last we chatted, you and I were actually doing a live Bitcoin ETF debate in New York City's Bryant Park, which was a blast. You put this out on Twitter. I'd like to think I held my own, but just in case, I've decided to stack the deck in my favor this time around. And so we also have Bitwise's Matt Hogan joining us. Matt, I understand you're already acquainted with Tyrone.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, so look, we don't have any script here. This is just going to be off the cuff. I think what might make the most sense is to maybe have both of you state your base case, and then we can go from there. I'll certainly jump in as well. And Matt, let's start with you. Why do you think a Bitcoin ETF is important? Because I always hear comments like an ETF goes against everything Bitcoin stands for, right? It's supposed to be decentralized outside of the traditional financial system. So why do we need a Bitcoin ETF?
Sure, I think that's easy. Look, the vast majority of wealth in the United States is controlled by financial advisors, and rightfully so. They do a good job of shepherding client assets. Right now, they have no safe, secure, cheap, trusted way to give their clients exposure to Bitcoin. And as a result, their portfolios aren't doing as well as they could. A very small allocation of Bitcoin can have a dramatic impact on a portfolio's Sharpe ratio. And the financial advisors need an ETF or a mutual fund product to access it. Right now, they're left with terrible options like GBTC. And I think it would be a win for American investors and their savers and their retirements and their futures if we could get a Bitcoin ETF approved.
So, Tyrone, give us your base position here. I know you're pro ETF, but against a Bitcoin ETF. Why don't you think a Bitcoin ETF is the answer?
Really quick, before I get to that, again, I have to say that I only have any credibility in the crypto space because of Matt. So I want to make that very clear. I love Matt. I love Bitwise. So I think everything Matt said was absolutely correct, but I still vehemently disagree. There's a bunch of ways I can go with this, but let's put a 10-year-old asset that advisors don't understand inside of a product that's roughly, 30 years old? Matt would know better than me, that studies show that most advisors don't understand. And then let's sell that product to investors who don't understand ETFs or Bitcoin. Recipe for disaster. Second thing is there is not a financial advisor that can prove suitability. And we had this debate on Twitter yesterday with another financial advisor. If you look at what suitability is, reasonable basis, okay, and there was 3 points, reasonable basis, right? I believe it was quantifiable analysis. Those two right away, most advisors can't satisfy. And then the third is customer suitability or something like that, customer acknowledgement or whatever. So if most advisors will get 1 out of 3. That's the main reason. Most advisors will not be able to sit and justify that it is a suitable thing to use an ETF for a client to access Bitcoin when Cash App exists. It just does not work. When the announcement that Shapeshift made yesterday, when it's non-custodial, they're eliminating counterparty risk and a client can trade and store Bitcoin on their hardware wallet and still trade, eliminating that counterparty risk. But we're supposed to put clients into a product that's going to trade 24/7. We don't know what it's going to cost. We don't know what will happen if there's, you know, some type of flash crash or something. And not to mention, right, and I think, as Matt's study has shown and Bitwise has shown, is that 95% of the volume isn't real. The 5% is very strong. But, again, I don't think that's enough for institutions and let alone the SEC or anyone else to say, okay, well, we're confident enough in that number to put to approve this product and then go out and put this in the hands of retail investors.
Matt, any response to that?
Well, I think there are two things that Tyrone is combining here, and I also have the utmost respect for Tyrone. He's one of the smartest people in crypto that I know. This is a mutual love fest. But he's combining two things. One, will the SEC approve it? And two, will financial advisors see it suitable to put into their products? Now, the SEC question is a separate one. You and I talked about that, Nate. I think we're getting very close. They're making sure that the markets are not manipulated. They're making sure that custody works. They're making sure that the partner that they allow to go through has checked all the boxes in terms of trading appropriately and storing this appropriately so that they can give a green light to an exchange-traded product. So let's set that aside. That's a separate debate. And then will financial advisors see fit to put it in their products? Both Tyrone and I know, I believe, that a small allocation to Bitcoin does wonderful things historically for portfolio returns and Sharpe ratios. So I think, you know, is it a suitable addition? I think the answer is right. And then he raises the question of Cash App. And it's certainly true that for a sophisticated crypto user like Tyrone or someone who's putting crypto at the core of their portfolio, there may be cheaper ways to access it than an ETF, but you don't get the comfort that you get in an ETF, that the custody solution has diligence, that it's easy to use, that it fits into your reporting standards, et cetera. It's like arguing that we should all trade on Robinhood because it's free when most financial advisors feel much more comfortable trading on Fidelity or Schwab or a platform that they're comfortable with. It doesn't have to be the absolute bottom dollar cheapest. It just has to be the one that you feel most secure with and that provides a reasonable exposure to investors.
Yeah, and Tyrone, if you don't mind, I want to pile in a little bit here just since we have our secret weapon, Matt Hogan, on the line. Look, when you talk about Cash App being a cheaper option, to Matt's point, it certainly is if you know how to navigate it. But there are all sorts of ETFs, mutual funds, hedge funds out there, right? Most of those own individual securities, so stocks, bonds, whatever. And obviously, they're not all going to be the cheapest option and certainly more expensive than investing in the individual securities, right? You have to pay a fund fee for those. So I'm going to try to invert this question. Are you saying that you would only invest your clients in individual stocks or bonds because you don't want to pay those, we'll call them convenience fees, that a fund might offer? Does that make sense? I feel like whatever a client is invested in has to be suitable, has to be right for them. They have to understand the risk that they're going to get just being invested in Bitcoin, whether that's through Cash App or through a Bitcoin ETF. But, you know, if the hurdle was the cheapest, then literally every investor would have to invest in the cheapest Vanguard funds or whatever in their accounts for stocks and bonds. I guess I personally don't view that as a hurdle. There has to be justification for the investment option, and the client's best interest should always be first. But, you know, I don't think cost is always the sole driver, is my point. What do you think about that?
No, it's not the sole driver, and that was the sole driver, it'd be a really weak argument. We can keep going. Cash App allows you, your crypto goes immediately into open source cold storage. Custody, solved, right? The custody solutions on the retail side are better than the institutional side right now. They're just farther along. So that's the first thing. Second thing is they now allow withdrawals and deposits. So if I want to take my crypto off of Cash App and then store it, you know, more securely, I can do that. Next level, right? Then you get into the estate planning piece of taking my buying it on Cash App or Coinbase or whatever, and be able to take one Bitcoin, put it in deep cold storage for, you know, my daughter's, you know, wedding or whatever the case may be. A lot of options there. Can't do that with an ETF. The other thing is this: TD Ameritrade, E-Trade. A bunch of folks now are going to allow that they're working to allow you to buy Bitcoin yourself through their platforms. Once that happens, again, what are we doing with the Bitcoin ETF? Now, I get it. I want to be very clear. It will get approved. It absolutely will. There's too much money at stake. I'm just saying, as a financial advisor, I do not understand how you can say to a client that if you know, and I think that's the main thing. I did a webinar with the Journal of Financial Planning. There's a whole bunch of CFPs on, and I told them, the reason why most financial advisors will use an ETF is because they don't know their other option. If they did, they would not be able to make that recommendation. That's one. Now, to your point, as far as the fees go, whatever, you'll be surprised. I do have a lot of clients that I drag into the equity market. They don't want to hold funds. They don't want to hold ETFs. They want to hold the actual security. They want to hold AMD. They want to hold Twilio. They want to hold Uber. They want to hold underlying individual stocks. So I think it's funny how that, you know, what's old is new again, right? That shift is coming back where you have younger investors who do want to invest in individual equities, but there is a place for ETFs for sure. But my whole part of the Cash App argument is not solely on cost.
Well, I think the other thing there too is just convenience though, right? So if your stocks and bonds and let's say you have a Bitcoin ETF are all custodied at Fidelity or Schwab, then you get consolidated performance reporting. You have consolidated tax reporting. I think there is something to that convenience. And especially if you're managing a client's overall allocation, if they have crypto held elsewhere, you may not see that. And again, you're not going to have that consolidated performance and tax reporting.
Again, yeah. I respectfully disagree. There's a startup called Lumina that I'm working with now that allows me to see an aggregated view of all my clients' crypto, no matter where it's held, and I can hold that in conjunction with all of their equity holdings. Again, you just have to know what's out there.
I would just toss in a few things, and Cash App is a fine solution for someone who's extremely sophisticated and has a lot of faith in a relatively unproven tool and knows how to handle things once they are in cold storage custody. You know, a few things make it impractical from my perspective. One, there's a dramatic limit on the amount of money you can invest on any given day through Cash App, which make it impractical for financial advisors with large clients to use that as a core approach to accessing the Bitcoin market. And two, I think just financial advisors are going to be more comfortable with a traditional approved third-party custody arrangement with a regulated custodian that has insurance. They're going to feel more comfortable with that than they will with an app that puts it into a cold storage solution that they don't understand. The thing that that financial advisors want more than anything is to not have their clients fire them. And the easiest way to get fired is to make a mistake with something you don't understand and miss some nuance,
right?
And therefore get lost. I just feel, you know, yes, there's opportunities for flash crashes in the equity markets, et cetera, but those opportunities are amplified in the crypto markets directly. And I think they'll feel more comfortable with an institutional layer intermediating them between the raw Bitcoin market and the clients that are used to traditional stocks and bonds.
Matt, Tyrone, Jason here. I just want to throw something in. I think about this interesting debate, and the best analogy I think about is gold. And as a practitioner, many of my clients have an allocation to gold, and it comes back to what's the best fit for the client. How do they get exposure and feel comfortable? And for I'd say the vast majority of my clients, an exchange traded product makes a heck of a lot of sense. Held in their brokerage account, you know, qualified, non-qualified, tax reporting, all the things. But there's a cost to that. You know, you're going to pay 20, 30, 40 bips for all of those things. If that's the right way to get exposure and the cost is disclosed, that's fine. I do have some clients with gold bars, though, and they're in a safe deposit box or, you know, buried in the backyard, wherever it may be. And that's right for a small number of people. I think that's how I think about Bitcoin and really crypto in general, is that there's a certain segment of the population that makes so much sense to have Cash App, Coinbase, whatever you're going to use. And then for a lot of folks, that ease of exposure just takes precedence. Does that make any sense?
That makes total sense with me, and I agree with that. And I think it's even more apt with Bitcoin, where you have to deal with things like hard forks and airdrops, and where trading is a bit more complex. But I think that analogy to gold is perfect, and we do see, you know, tens of billions of dollars of investor assets tied up in gold ETPs, willing to pay the convenience fee because it's in a wrapper that they're comfortable with and a liquidity that they're comfortable with.
All right, before we move on here, because I do want to get to a couple of non-Bitcoin ETF questions that we got from Twitter. Tyrone, any parting words regarding a Bitcoin ETF?
I think most of what, not even most of, I think all of what Matt said is absolutely correct. I'm going to be the outlier. I will have an epic meltdown when it is approved. and I will broadcast it live. But I want to make this clear, though. A couple things. One is my practice is a little different because I do deal with tech-native young clients who completely understand crypto. And I don't have to pitch Bitcoin. I don't have to pitch an ETF or any of this. They come to me with it. right? I don't give investment management advice, right? They have a portfolio. I look at it and I go, ooh, some of this is a little scary, but they're not going to change it based on what I say. There are certain things that they want advice on, and that's that. The last piece I think is very important is this. I believe personally financial advisors in the future will not be doing crypto, building crypto portfolios or managing assets and charging a fee on crypto. I think that's not going to happen, which is why my practice is set up now so that, again, my clients store, buy, transact away from me, and they come to me for the advice. So I think that's where the business is going, not only in crypto, by the way, but that's a whole other podcast. But I think that's why I have the views that I have. But, again, Matt is completely correct. It will get approved. Financial advisors are going to use it. Everyone's going to make a ton of money. And I'll just be the angry guy screaming at the clouds.
Matt, any parting words from you?
I don't think that's true, Tyrone. I think your business is going to do just fine. And people who are sophisticated in crypto should give Tyrone a call. Look, I think we agree on a few things. I think we agree that most investors will be better off with at least a small allocation to crypto. And also that the tools for accessing that are getting better every day. Cash App is a great tool if you're sophisticated and a small investor. I think an ETF will be a great tool when and if it's approved for financial advisors looking to put clients into it. So, you know, the world is getting better. It's getting better in the crypto space every day, and it's just a matter of time until it's available to more and more people.
Extremely well said by both of you. Real quick, there are two questions I want to get to from Twitter. The first came from Captain Momentum, and the question is, where does Bitcoin go in a portfolio? So is it within alts and real assets? Is it alongside tech? And this person also asked, how can you possibly use any traditional portfolio modeling techniques with Bitcoin? Any quick thoughts on that, Matt?
Sure. I think it goes in the alternative sleeve. I think it's a hedge against inflation and against a runaway Fed. I think it goes sort of in line with the gold allocation, much more so than the tech allocation. The answer on the modeling thing is interesting. If you put just raw Bitcoin into a portfolio optimizer and let it run, the portfolio optimizer will tell you to run for the hills. The important thing to do is to constantly rebalance it. As with any volatile asset, having a diligent rebalancing strategy is critical to making it work in a portfolio setting. So we use tolerance-based rebalancing. You can also use sort of calendar-based rebalancing, but it is critical to have a rebalancing discipline when you have a portfolio, an asset as volatile as Bitcoin.
Tyrone, any thoughts?
No, I agree. In a traditional portfolio, Matt nailed it. In the portfolios that I see where clients come to me and they own 100% crypto, Bitcoin is essentially like a large cap holding, right? It's like they're Johnson & Johnson almost, and it's surrounded by all some underwater ICOs that will never see the light of day and things like that. And then what happens is they rotate out of alts into Bitcoin and then out of Bitcoin into alts, depending on what's going on in the market and, you know, other opportunities to come up. So in a traditional portfolio, exactly right, I think a alt sleeve, but in a traditional, what will be a traditional crypto portfolio based on the portfolios that I see, it is a core, you know, large cap holding because it is the most lendy for now. And the biggest brand and the most recognizable.
All right. Another comment came from Daniil Shapiro, who's actually going to join us on ETF Prime later this summer. And Matt, this may be more geared towards you, but he asked about institutional adoption of Bitcoin. If pensions and sovereign wealth funds get involved, maybe that could be a huge game changer for Bitcoin. Are you seeing anything there at Bitwise?
Yeah, we're seeing conversations advance. Look, where the real institutional investors are right now is they're making their first allocations to venture-based crypto equity investments through firms like Andreessen, and they're starting to study the crypto token market, actual crypto assets like Bitcoin or Ethereum. I think you'll see the first sort of wave of pension funds and institutions making small experimental allocations into crypto in the next 12 months. But it's not like they're knocking at the door. The people who are starting to invest now, and we talked about this earlier in the show, are really much smaller foundations, family offices, et cetera. Those people, more experimental, they're starting to invest now. The big sovereign wealth pension fund, that will be a huge catalyst, a huge accelerant, but that still is a little bit of a ways off.
Well, Matt, with that, we'll let you go. Really appreciate your time this week. Always fun discussing a Bitcoin ETF. No doubt this is going to continue to be a story to track the rest of the year, much to Tyrone's chagrin. But thank you. Thank you for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Hogan, Global Head of Research at Bitwise. Tyrone, we have a few minutes left, and there are two other areas I wanted to touch on before we let you go. First, just on the topic of crypto education, what do you think advisors should be doing here? What do you think their responsibility is just at a basic level?
Listening. I think that's the main thing right now from what I'm talking to advisors and what I'm hearing from frustrated prospects and, you know, clients of other advisors is they're not listening. So just be open to the conversation for one. That's the main thing. Something else I also mentioned on that webinar. And I think the other thing is robust education. Educate yourself so that, one, you can answer questions if clients come to it, come with them rather, or, you know, and you can educate yourself to be able to at least, you know, fulfill your fiduciary responsibility and say no with probable reason and cause, and you, or you could say yes, we'll allocate to it, you know, with probable reason and cause as well. So I think education right now is important. I think listening, and to be honest, do I think most advisors, should they be putting money into the space right now? No. I think it's just there's a lot of things that still need to be satisfied in order to do that. Maybe a goofy Bitcoin ETF is one, but when that gets there, everyone's going to have at it anyway. So I think even if an ETF gets approved, and when it does, if advisors are educated now, I think they'll be a little bit more prudent in terms of how they actually, you know, allocate clients to it.
Tyrone, Jason, again, I think you made a great point. We can't, as advisors, be credible in this space unless we know what we're talking about. At the very least, should an advisor who's looking over the space, you know, $100, open a Cash App, open a Coinbase, buy some, sell some, transfer some, just get familiar with the process and get that base knowledge. Is that a minimum for an advisor at this point?
100%. 100%. Just go, you know, try, again, whatever works for you, right? Coinbase, Cash App, whatever the case may be, Abra, list is endless, and try it yourself and get that experience. And see what that's like, because again, with that Libra announcement and Facebook going all in on this, that was the worst nightmare to advisors who completely wanted to stick their head in the sand on this, because your clients are going to have experience with quote unquote crypto or blockchain in some way. So you should at least understand some of the UX and some of the terms and uploading and selling and what that looks like, a QR code and private key and public key. Absolutely. That was a really great point.
Well, something else that I'll add there, and Tyrone, you and I have seen this all the time, advisors just completely dismissing the crypto space, calling Bitcoin a sham. And look, maybe Bitcoin doesn't make it longer term, but I would argue that as an advisor, you have an obligation to both understand investments your clients should be invested in and ones they shouldn't be invested in. So even if you 100%. Don't believe in crypto, you need to educate yourself on it so you can then inform your clients on why they shouldn't be investing in it. And I think that's something that gets lost in the shuffle. Real quick, you mentioned Facebook's Libra coin. I know you've been pretty outspoken on Twitter. My sense is you view this as a huge positive for financial inclusion, despite Facebook's track record on data privacy and the fact that Libra isn't decentralized like Bitcoin. So why is that?
So there's a bunch of reasons why, but I think let's look at the basics. Everyone took the headlines and really didn't read the white paper and took whatever one they'd taken and were screaming and not really looking at what they wanted to do here. If you read the first page of it, their mission is a very noble call. So me being who I am, anyone who wants to help the voices and the disenfranchised deserves a shot. Secondly, Facebook is just the name. Libra, the organization, and Calibra, those are separate entities away from Facebook. That's the second thing. Third thing is this. 7 out of 10 teenagers on Facebook come from families that make $30,000 a year. 34 million people in this country by the United Way were considered working poor. You know what all of these people have? A phone. You know what all of these people have access to? Facebook. You know what all of these people struggle to do? Get their time back. You know what Facebook wants to do? Give these people their time back. Well, Tyra, what is money? Money is time. When you're poor, money is a great asset. Time is better. Because if I could pay my bills and not have to travel a half hour and spend the gas on a car that may broke down or a car that may be repossessed, and I could pay those bills from my phone. I have an hour now to go maybe pick up an hour in overtime at work or spend an hour with my kids or make sure that we don't get evicted and my kids are here safe or no intruders come in. Yes, that's worst case scenario. Let's go to a less worse scenario. Someone that is working poor and just simply working 40, 60 hours a week, exhausted at the end of the week, can't travel, can't go pay bills. They can sit there and do all of that from their phone. Let's go a higher level. There's 1 billion, so 1.7 billion or whatever people in the world that don't have checking accounts. And here's what Facebook wants to do. They want to give people identity. That is such an amazing thing. They want to give people identity after we identify you, not in terms of we physically see you, not that. We're going to give you an identity. We're going to make you a person with the technology that we have, and then we're going to give you access to banking. Are you kidding me? Who could have a problem with this? And if you do, again, it comes from an elitist, privileged perspective because we have multiple accounts and checking and this and that. There are a lot of people who don't have this. Half of the people in the South Bronx in this country, the most developed, richest country in the world, don't have a bank account. The largest amount of child poverty is in this country. And we're worried about whether Facebook, whether Libra is going to compete with Bitcoin. We're missing the mark. So there have been no crypto companies and no financial services companies, if we're being honest, that said, you know what, let's turn our eye to those who have less than. And if Facebook wants to be the one to do that, or Libra, or they want to hide behind whoever, that's fantastic. The other thing was everyone spoke about, oh, it's they're partnering with Uber and they're partnering with Visa and MasterCard. No one focused on the nonprofit organizations that they said we will partner with because you can help us get proximate to people that we can't reach. Will you partner with us? And plenty of credible, notable, Kiva being one. Right, the Women's Foundation being two, that said that they would help them get proximate to people in need is an extremely powerful thing, and I think the message was lost in whether it's decentralized or centralized or not. Who cares? There are people who need the help, and they're not screaming about the color of the life preserver, so if Facebook wants to help them, so be it. But I understand my perspective is but I'm that person. I come from that family, so I have a direct passion and desire to see those people help. And I was screaming up and down that the crypto's biggest use case is people who are unbanked, people who are disenfranchised, people who have never had a bank account. My parents just got their first account together, 40 years together. They just got their first joint account less than a year ago. They lived their whole lives unbanked. And now Facebook wants to help them. So there'll be a couple like my parents who won't have to struggle like we did because Facebook wants to help them. I think we have to back up and take a look at the bigger picture here, and I think it is at least something that people will be able to get behind if they look at it from that perspective.
Tyrone, I will debate you all day long on a Bitcoin ETF. There is absolutely nothing to debate with what you just said. That was simply amazing. What you just said should be spliced and sent out to anybody who doesn't understand what Facebook's trying to do, doesn't understand crypto. I think you just hit on seriously, one of the more important things that has been said on this particular podcast. I know you like to use the free jewelry hashtag. Yeah. You just dropped a full truckload of free jewelry on our listeners. Tyrone, I really appreciate your time this week. This was a lot of fun. We're definitely going to have to do it again. I'd love to do a pod on the advisor fee discussion, which I know you're also very passionate about. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yo, thank you for having me. Again, I appreciate you sharing your platform with me, and I'm truly humbled and grateful. You guys have a great day.
Thank you. That was Tyrone Ross. Highly recommend giving him a follow on Twitter. He's at TR401. That's TR401. And you can also contact him via his website, TyroneRoss.io. That'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit LeggMason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, Michael Venuto, co-founder of Toroso, will lay out the investment case for the SoFi Gig Economy ETF. We'll also hit Mike with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. And then Andrew Channon, CEO at Procure AM, will spotlight the Procure Space ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.